stuff that's left over still here, and it's all in the hall right now. And I'm sure he made this announcement the last hour, but it's out in the hall. And when church is over at 12:30, and I'll be finished before that at 12:30, you can go out there, and the hall is still full of stuff. We sold a ton of stuff, but there was a ton of stuff that was here. And so anything that is out there, you can have for whatever price you determine. The goal is to get rid of the stuff, and you get to determine the price. And John said checks are welcome because it all goes to a good cause. And so you can go out there, and anything you see you want, you determine the price and get it out of here. And so that's in the hall as we leave. Just FYI, while we're on the topic of raising funds for our building, we understand that we can't have enough garage sales and auctions to raise the money. Let's say we raised $100,000 yesterday. You got to have a lot of auctions to raise $13 million, $12 to $13 million. So the only way we're going to be able to do this is to, at some point, all of us get in our own prayer closet and figure out what the Lord would have us to do. And we're trying to structure the future such that we give you the opportunity to really think it through, kind of like what we did for our sanctuary. We'll have home fireside chats. We're going to segregate the family into our family groups. In other words, this is a Bible study family. We're all a part of the Sagemont family, but we're a Bible study family, and we'll segregate our church into different family groups, and we'll have opportunities to come to the this family. I'll open up my home, and Stuart may open up his home, and we'll open up four or five homes over a course, and we would want you to come to a home so that we can show you. You can get intimate with the building itself, show you the building, look at the building, hear John speak on a video. John may be there to speak a word to it. I'll be there. Stuart will be there. We'll talk to. Here's what we're doing. For most of us in this class, we're not going to enjoy the fruit of this building. I mean, this is a youth building, and we are planting a seed of a tree under whose shade most of us won't sit under. I'm not going to sit under this shade tree. My kids aren't going to sit under this shade tree. My grandkids are. And so we're getting ready for the future. There's a succession team in place in our church life, and they're meeting now. John 78, he's not going to be here forever. I don't know a date. I don't think there's been a date given, but he's not going to be here forever. And we're getting ready for the future, and that's inclusive of someday having a new pastor, someday having a new building, having great facilities here, and we all ought to get on board with a great goodbye, whenever that good guy is going to be. Building this building isn't a one-year project. It's probably not a two-year project. It's probably a three-year project. And so we need the resources to do it. We do it debt-free. And so we're going to have fireside chats at our home, and you're going to be challenged. The purpose of the fireside chat, so that you can see the vision, be challenged, be thinking of what we can do right now and what you can do over the course of this building project. And to God be the glory, we're going to have when the senior staff that are 60 and above exodus, we leave this place stronger than ever before. That's kind of the goal, that when we do make that exodus and that transition, great facilities are in place for whoever the leader is into the future. And to God be the glory, we'll be reaching people here for a long, long, long time. We need a new building, the last new building project for a while, because this is the oldest. Our children, our youth don't have good buildings. This will be a great building. All of it was destroyed during Harvey. We can't remodel it. We can't rebuild it. We got to take it to the ground, build it up. That's what we're doing. So be ready. We're meeting this Wednesday to try to do the background of what the fireside chats are going to take, how they're going to take place, and when they're going to take place. So be ready for that and sign up for that. And we, as the 11 o'clock class family, will get together, and you'll be challenged. Thank you for blessing and loving and being with my wife. You keep asking, so I'll keep responding. We've had the last chemo treatment. It's been a difficult week. Twice this week we had to go down to MD Anderson for the emergency room. The chemo that kills the cancer also kills the hair cells and the enzymes that kill the bacteria in your digestive system. And so she's been in a lot of pain with urinary tract infections, and they've had to change antibiotics a couple of times. So it's been a rough week. We're in the red zone. We can see the end zone. We're getting there. Surgery in April. I'm not going to give you the date because I don't want you to be there. You understand that. I mean, it'd be overwhelming. And so surgery is in front of us, and we're getting there. Thank you for blessing my wife and praying for my wife. Keep on praying for her, okay? All right. We are in the book. Oh, by the way, we're almost finished with this book. We're going to go to the book of James. I think, Joe, you and some others recommended James, and so we'll do James. And if you don't like it, blame Joe Henderson in this class because he recommended that. And I kind of like that book, Count It All Joy. And we'll get there in the days ahead. One last announcement, just an FYI. On Tuesday, I will meet with the commander, the colonel of the 147th Fighter Wing at Ellington. He's called us, wants to meet with us so that we can brainstorm how they can be involved with our Memorial Day celebration. And so you know we have a two-star general coming on that weekend. He'll preach the sermon, and he'll preach the service outside amongst the 38,000 flags. And we hope to have the 147th. We hope that there's 7,000 military personnel out at Ellington. We hope that many of them will come out here for our worship services and for our flag display. And the goal is not just to honor those who have sacrificed what Abraham Lincoln called the ultimate sacrifice, but to point our community to the Son who, when he sets you free, you're free indeed. And he laid down his life for eternal freedom. And so that's our ultimate goal. We're not coy about that at all. We want our community to see Jesus high and lifted up. And so pray for that weekend. If you're prone to want to give to that, you could designate a check on flags, put flags down there. There are costs associated with this year's projects that aren't covered in last year's budget. So if you want to help defray those costs, it would be a blessing to me. Either that or I'm not giving to the Envision campaign. All right. So that's one or the other. So anyway, we've got that before us as well. All right. Allow me to pray. Visitors, we're glad, really blessed that you are here. Stuart and I team teach through the Bible. We are in 2 Samuel chapter 23 today. Lord Jesus, may we see the things that you want us to see. And not just see it, may we want to apply it. David is saying goodbye. It's a four-chapter goodbye. It's an epilogue to the book of Samuel, and he's really just dialoguing what it takes to be a great person of God, great man or woman of God. And may we see the things that he camps on, and may we want to be all that you want us to be. In Jesus' name, amen. So we are in chapter 23, and honestly, chapter 22, 23, 24. You've got a 3 or 4 chapter epilogue. You remember that Samuel wasn't always 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. In its penmanship, it was Samuel. It was many centuries later that they made 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. And so what you're really getting is the conclusion of the book of Samuel. And so you've got 4 chapters where David is reminiscing. He's looking back over the past, the trials, the tribulations, the victories, the goodness of God, his own failures, and he's also meditating upon the future. And so that's what is happening in this chapter. You'll notice in verse 1 it says David's last song. Other texts would call it David's song of salvation, or the last words of David. We're coming to the conclusion of his kingship, and he's wrapping it up, and he's reminiscing. And most of us, if we could get honest, most of us as we get older, we do some reminiscing. We look back down the past, the good old days, which weren't always all that good, and we think about some things we did right, and we think about some things we did wrong, and some of the things we prioritize today aren't the things we prioritized then, and so we reminisce about the good old days. But for many of us today, we also not just look back at the past, we look forward to eternity, to the future, and so we focus on some things that perhaps we didn't focus on when we were younger, and we think about the land that is fairer than day. And we think about in the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. In the sweet by and by, we shall meet on that beautiful shore. We think about the things of God and the things of eternity where perhaps we didn't think of them when we were younger. I have found a text that I have used several times in funerals this past year that I think speaks to this issue. The text is given in the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon is that author. This is the son of David, getting ready to be the next king. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 2, Solomon penned these words, "It is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living take it to heart. That's pretty straightforward. The paraphrase, the Living Bible, makes it crystal clear to understand. In the Living Bible, it says it like this: "It is better to spend your time at funerals than at parties, for you are going to die, and it is a good thing to think about it while there is still time." And that kind of sums it up. You know, when we're young, we're anxious about going to parties. When we're old, we end up going to a lot of funerals. And that's not all bad, because at funerals, we stop and take inventory, and we think about the brevity of life and the sureness of death. Billy Graham rightly said, we are a death-denying culture. And honestly, when I was young, I didn't want to do funerals. I wanted to do weddings. Weddings were fun, and weddings were happy. And nobody listens to a preacher at a wedding. And now that I'm older, I'd rather do a funeral, because at least at funerals, some people are there, and they stop, and they take inventory, and they think about the brevity of life and the sureness of death. So I've done a 180. I would much rather do a funeral service than a wedding service, because people sometimes listen at funerals. And that's what Solomon is saying in this text. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to a party, because at a funeral, you take some things that are being said to heart. You think about it. And that's what David is doing in our text today. He's going down memory lane, and he's thinking about some things that we all ought to be thinking about. There's a book that was put out by a guy named Joe Bailey, and the name of the book was A View from the Hearse. And the book is all about Christians when they die. And you understand that our view at the point of death is different than those who die without any hope. The View from the Hearse. Now, this author passed away, and after he passed away, they changed the name of the book, and now the title is, I think it's The Last Thing We Ever Talk About. That's okay, but I personally like The View from a Hearse. You know, I like the concept that here we are, not all of you, but if you're, I'm 65 now, you know, I think about things that I didn't think about many years ago. And so my view about the past and my view about the eternity is a lot different than it used to be. I think more and more about the view from the hearse. Am I going to finish well? Am I going to hear, "Well done, my good and faithful servant"? What about you? Don't you want to finish well? Well, how do you finish well? That's what David is talking about in the text today. What was yesterday's priorities aren't necessarily the priorities of today. How many of you have ever heard of a guy named Malcolm Muggeridge? Anybody? Oh, there's a few of you, not many, no more than a handful in each class. Let me introduce Malcolm Muggeridge to you. How many of you ever heard of Lee Strobel? Lee Strobel, A Case for Christ. Well, Lee Strobel was the Yale law student that went to work for the Chicago Tribune, agnostic, atheistic, hated God, was challenged about God, met Jesus as Lord and Savior, wrote the book, The Case for Christ, and so now does apologetics, has been to Sagemont. And so what I'm saying to you, that Malcolm Muggeridge was to England what Lee Strobel is to America. But Malcolm Muggeridge was to England in the 1900s what Lee Strobel has been to America in the 2000s. And so Malcolm Muggeridge served the British Army in World War II and eventually became a British spy. He was a spy during the war, and after the war, he became a journalist and traveled quite a bit. And by his own testimony, he was a womanizer. He was very popular. He was on early TV shows. And so he was a James Bond before James Bond was James Bond. You know, spy and a womanizer, and he's agnostic, didn't believe in God. And in 1969, Malcolm Muggeridge got saved. He was beautifully saved, and he authored several books, just like Lee Strobel. And his books include Something Beautiful for God, A Third Testament, Modern Pilgrim Explores the Spiritual Wanderings of Augustine and Blake and Pascal and Bonhoeffer, The Chronicles of a Wasted Time, the Jesus Rediscovered, Christ in the Media, Jesus the Man Who Lives, and Confessions of a 20th Century Pilgrim. And so these were the writings of Malcolm Muggeridge, and some of his quotes are just priceless. One of the quotes of Malcolm Muggeridge is something that's just all too true. He said, "The depravity of man is at once the most empirically verifiable reality, but at the same time, the most intellectually resisted fact." That's all true. How many of you know that we're all sinners? You know, that's the depravity of man. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. He said, that's empirical fact. It's easy to prove, but it's the most resisted truth on planet Earth with intelligent people. The educators and academia and the elitist of the world, they shake their fist. Man's evolving to greatness and goodness, and no, he's not a sinner. And Malcolm Muggeridge said, that's all folly. Malcolm Muggeridge said this about the demise of Western civilization. He said, so the final conclusion would surely be that whereas other civilizations have been brought down by attacks of barbarians from without, and that's true, most civilizations have been destroyed by other civilizations, the barbarians. He goes on and said, ours has the distinct, unique distinction of training its own destroyers at its own educational institutions and then providing them with facilities for propagating their destructive ideology far and wide, all at the public expense. Thus did Western man decide to abolish himself, creating out of his own boredom, out of his own affluence, his own vulnerability, out of his own strength, his own impotence, out of his own erotomania, himself blowing the trumpet that brought the walls of his own city tumbling down, and having convinced himself that he was too numerous, labored with pill and scalpel and syringe to make himself fewer, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility and polluted and drugged himself into stupefaction, he kneeled over a weary old brontosaurus and became extinct. And so basically he said, hey, we educated ourselves into extinction. And we were the own cause of our own demise. And don't you see that happening before your very eyes today? I bring up Malcolm Muggeridge to say I remember, a TV program in the 80s, something like 60 Minutes. I don't remember. But it was Malcolm Muggeridge, and I was a young Christian, and I was trying to grow, and he's now a Christian and talking about the things of the Lord. And I don't remember the exact words, but it was something like this. He was standing at his family's cemetery, and he was having a view of from the hearse, so to speak. And he said, I'm standing here with my family, where my family is buried, knowing that it will not be long before I join them. I must say that when I look back on my life from this vantage point, I realize that many of the things I most dreaded in my younger days, I now praise as having played a very significant and profitable role in my life. Conversely, the things that I thought were most needful, I have found to be the least significant and beneficial to me. And I think that's true of most human beings. How many of you would honestly say, some things that I thought were important when I was 18, I don't find to be important anymore? And conversely, some things I now think are important when I'm 65, I think that way back when they didn't register on the radar. When you were younger, what were the goals of your life? What did you prioritize? What were you thinking about trying to be and become? Somebody? Yes, sir. For tomorrow we die. That's good. Yeah, mine gets more crass than that, but I get it, okay? Somebody else, who's speaking? Somebody else, what were your goals in life and living when you were younger? Yes, sir. Get married and get a job. Somebody else. Oh, come on, the other two classes were ripe with real stuff. Your goals in life, yes, sir. Clint. Sir? Yeah, me too, get rich. I wasn't thinking billions, but just back then, a million, right? Yeah, I wanted to be rich. I didn't know how I wanted to be rich, what I had to do to be rich, but I wanted to be rich. Somebody else. Oh, come on, guys, you never thought about girls? Come on, let's get real in here. Yeah, the two-legged deer. Okay, I'm just saying your priorities when you're 18, not necessarily the priorities when you're 65. And conversely, the priorities of 65, not necessarily the priorities you had when you were 18. That's what Muggeridge is saying. Was there another hand back over here? Somebody else on a priority? Yes, Mac. They wouldn't admit it, but you know it's true, Mac. Look, true statement. When I was 17 years old, I was Methodist, and I'm not going to say I was a Christian. I thought I was a Christian. I was more a Christianette. You know, I went to church every now and then. I was a Christianette. I wasn't a Christian. But I knew that the last thing I wanted to be on planet Earth was a Baptist Christian. I'm not making that up. I was a Methodist Christian, and I was completely content with being a Methodist Christian, and I had my stereotype of a Baptist Christian. And the very last thing, I'd become a stark raving atheist before I became a Baptist Christian. Why? What was my stereotype of Baptist Christians? Well, no drinking, no dancing, no women, no gambling, wear white socks. I mean, I just didn't want to be a... The last thing I wanted to be when I was 17 years old was a Baptist Christian. They had no fun on planet Earth in my worldly experience as a 17-year-old. And so the last thing I wanted to be was a Baptist Christian. And then I got saved when I was 19. And then I started going to different churches because I realized I was out of sync with the church that I had my membership in. And I started going to try to find out. I was doing a spiritual pilgrimage to find out where to go to church to put on the armor of God. And there was a brand new preacher down downtown Houston named John Bisogno. John Bisogno. And I went down to John Bisogno, and he opened up the book and said, "Thus saith the Lord." And I went, "Oh my goodness, I'm going to become a Baptist Christian." The rest is history. I'm just saying, your priorities with life change. That's what I'm saying. Was there a hand up over here? Okay. I wasn't at that time. Rest assured, I was not praising the Lord at that time. A couple of weeks ago, we had Western Day at our church. You know, we had Western Day, and all the staff wore Western clothes. It was a family fun time, and get to know you. And so some of the staff made wanted posters for all of the ministerial staff, all right? We had wanted. So put up my wanted poster. This is from my past. There's Brother Chuck Schneider, yeah, a.k.a. the horse thief. How many of you know I stole a horse when I was younger? Yeah, I did. I did. When I was 17 years old, I'm a member of Spring Branch High School, and I'm a junior, and Memorial High School seniors came over and stole our mascot, the bear. They stole our bear, and they branded the bear with their mascot's horse. They were the Mustangs, and they branded our bear with horseshoes in his rear end. And I was dating a Memorial cheerleader, and I vowed the vow, "I will steal your Mustang." Okay, and she said, "Well, that's impossible." "Well, that's like telling you impossible." I said, "Okay, we'll see." And so between my junior year and senior year in high school, and now look, I'm a brown noser. I knew the principal. I'm on the student council. I'm boy state rep for the high school. And I went to the principal, and I quit the job that I had for several summers, construction company, making real good money. And I asked him to get me a job with the school district, minimum wage. And he got me the job with the school district. I did it with the intent purpose. I was to service air conditioning units in the 32 schools in the Spring Branch Independent School District. And every day I went to a different school to service the air conditioners. Somewhere around July, they gave me Memorial High School, and I got the master key to Memorial High School, and I went and copied the master key at lunch, and I went all through the high school to where I found their Mustang, and then I went and recruited the other cheerleaders at Spring Branch High School, and we went and stole their Mustang. We stole their Mustang, and we took it out, and we had it. And later in the year, in the football season, we needed the Springwoods Tigers to beat the Memorial Mustangs so that we could win district. And so we decided to tiger stripe that big old Mustang. And we tiger stripe, and we took it back to the high school, and we put 20 chains around him on the flagpole so that when all the students showed up, they would blame Springwoods for stealing their Mustang. And sure enough, they did, and they broke into the Springwoods field house and stole all their football helmets. And the game was delayed for 2 hours. And I'm doing this. And sure enough, we ended up winning district, and it was a secret for a long time, and I never repented of it. Still to this day, I haven't repented of it. And at the end of the school year, there was a teacher, an English teacher, said, "You need to write a paper on anything fictitious you want to write." And so I wrote a paper, "How to Steal a Mustang." And I, you know, you got to tell these things. You know, how to steal a Mustang. And I'm just a B student in high school, and I sent that paper in, and as God is my witness, as that teacher came back the next week with that paper, she had a grin from ear to ear, and she said, this was the best read among the whole faculty, and it had A++++ on it, and thumbs up on it. And I'm still doing this. I'm still doing this. And so still to this day, I haven't repented about that, all right? So that's why it says Chuck Schneider, a.k.a. Horse Thief. And, of course, Stuart had his picture up there. So put Stuart's picture up there. So, oh, no, that's me. Bring it back. I'm sorry, we handed me. So that's me on the Mustang. Bring the Mustang back if you can, Mike. And so you see the tiger stripe Mustang, and I'm in my letter jacket, and I'm holding up a key that I had from the high school. That's the key in my hand. Did we lose it, Mike? There it is. So there I am on the Mustang that we tiger striped and sent to the high school. So I am a horse thief. It is true, okay? And so some of the staff knew that, and that's why they have it. And I'm holding a key in my hand. And so now this is Stuart's wanted poster. So go to Stuart's wanted poster. And so there's Brother Stuart, a.k.a. the jester. And if you can't read it, for poking fun at his teaching partner in crime. And he does. He's malicious and he's mean and he's vile and he says ugly things. And I would never do that. And so that's Brother Stuart. And pray for him. Okay, take it off. The point. We look back and it's all too common. We reminisce. We think about the past, but the past is the past, and it's not enough just to think about the past. You ought to also focus on the future, and that's what David does here, his view from the hearse. And here's David's goal in the text that we're going to look at. David's goal, he's trying to answer the question for you and me, what makes a man or a woman a great man or woman of God? That's it. Man, he's done it all. He's done it right. He's done it wrong. He's done it all. And he's looking back, and he's now he knows that God's speaking to him, and he's telling through this psalm the last words. It's not his last words like a deathbed. It's his last psalm. You know, he wrote most of the psalms. And like last week, Stuart did chapter 22. That's Psalm 18. Go check me out. Those are almost identical. And now this is a short psalm, 7 verses long, that doesn't make the book of Psalms, but this is his last psalm, if you will. And he's answering the question, what makes a person a great person of God? So, verse 1 of chapter 23. Now, these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares. The man who was raised on high declares. The anointed of God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord spoke to me, and His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me, He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of the Lord, is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs out of the earth, through sunshine after rain. Truly is not my house so with God? For He has made an everlasting covenant with me, ordered in all things and secured. For all my salvation and all my desire, will He not indeed make it grow? But the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns, because they cannot be taken in hand. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and with the shaft of a spear, and they will be completely burned with fire in their place. Sometimes reading the Psalms, at least for me, is kind of difficult to understand exactly what is being said. And sometimes you have to back it up and go verse by verse and get out some good scholarship to understand exactly the meaning of what is being declared. And that's what it's like was like for me with this text as I first read it. I went, what? What is going on here? First of all, let me just say verse 1. I don't believe are the words of David. I think verse 1 is the author of Samuel declaring this is what David is getting. These are the last words of David. You'll see in the New American Standard, the parentheses, the quotation marks, they start with verse 2. I think David's words in this psalm start with verse 2, in that verse 1 where the author speaks of the man who was raised on high, the sweet psalmist of Israel. This is not David talking of himself. These are the words. What what the author is saying is completely true, but this is the author giving accolades to the sweet psalmist of Israel. And now the words of David starting at verse 2. The Spirit of the Lord spoke to me. David understood that there were times when God was speaking to him directly, and in fact, his words become holy writ. Many of the Psalms were penned by David, and they are, in essence, holy writ. David knew that there were times when the Lord spoke to him personally, and that's all he's saying right here. The Spirit of the Lord spoke to me. Now, I would say to you that 99.9% of the time, the Lord speaks to you and he speaks to us right here in his word. David did not have a finished canon. He did not have 66 books of the Bible. He might have had some inkling of the law, but he did not have the finished canon. The canon was being produced, and many of the words that David spoke became canon, and he acknowledged that God had given him that. But we get it right here from God 99% of the time, 99.9% of the time. I'm not going to say always, because I think in my own life there's been two or three times where God has spoken a word to me directly. Like when he called me into ministry, I heard a tangible voice. Now, whether it was in my spirit or tangible, I don't know, but I heard the voice of the Lord in my calling. And so I don't think that's the rule. I think that's the exception. David, it was the rule. The Spirit of the Lord spoke to me, and then he declares, he who rules over men must be just. As David looked back over his life, as he reminisced, he struck by the great need for rulers to rule justly or righteously. And you look at governments today, it's kind of like, why did we revolt from England? Because of tyranny. Governments either have just rulers or tyrannical leaders. We rebelled from England because of the tyranny. And David's saying, to be a good ruler, you got to be just. You got to be right. You got to be righteous. That's the backbone of being a good ruler, not doing it for yourself. Let me put it like this. How many of you would say that all of our leaders in America today are just leaders and do it right? Yeah, I doubt it. You're shaking your head and you're going, no, you're mumbling no, and you would say something's wrong. But David gives the key to being a just ruler in the next verse. He says, ruling in the fear of God. The key to being a just ruler, the key to being a righteous ruler, is understanding that you, the ruler, are not the Alpha and the Omega. You're not the beginning of the end. You're not the who's who. You are a man under authority who rules in the fear of the Lord. Now, the word fear is a word that doesn't connote all that it did when the authors used that word, and even in the King James English. Now, fear is a bad thing. But fear literally means in awe of God. A person that rules in justice rules in awe of God or in respect of God, or he's a man under God. He's a man that realizes he's not the Alpha and Omega. God is. He's a man that has stooped and condescended, and he's a man who's an instrument of God, but he isn't God. And by the way, this goes all the way back to the garden. This is the warfare that took place in the garden. We shall be like the Most High God. God's holding out on you. Eat the fruit, and you shall be like the Most High God. And so there's two types of rulers. Rulers that are people under God and rulers who are people not under God. And so David said, in order to be a good ruler, in order to be a just ruler, you got to be a man under God. You got to be a man that knows that God is boss. God is God. God is Lord. And you are his servant. You aren't God. That's basically what David is saying. And that contrast is still in play today. Don't you understand? That's the problem with what we're seeing today. And so David is saying a good ruler is a just ruler, and a good ruler rules in the fear of the Lord, and that's the key to being a good ruler. And he shall be like the light of morning. He shall be like the dew on the grass. He's using metaphors here. I love to fish. I love to be up at dark. I love to be on the water when the sun is coming up. I love to see the first rays of light. And so I read this and I go, yeah, that's pretty cool, because that is pretty important. And David says, that's what it's like to be a good ruler. Now, you might protest at this point and go, well, David wasn't that good of a ruler. You know, David's reign was a disaster. You know, he had horrible sin. The sin led to family rebellion and civil war, and then there was another civil war, and then there was 3 years of famine, and it was a mess from beginning to end. And in one respect, that is right. And you might even go on and say, contrast David's reign and rule to his son Solomon's reign and rule. Solomon's reign and rule seemed perfect. Solomon enjoyed a perfect reign of peace and great prosperity and unbelievable prominence. And a lot of glory was brought to Solomon. Solomon had the perfect kingdom and kingship, but not David. But wait a second. Read the rest of the Bible. You go to the rest of the Bible, and David's kingship was extolled throughout the rest of the Bible. And you never hear about Solomon's kingship. It's never a reference to it. But David's flag is always raised through the rest of the Bible. You get over to the book of Isaiah, the 55th chapter, verse 3 and 4. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen that you may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you according to the faithful mercies shown to David. This is several hundred years after David. And they're still saying, oh, I'm going to bless you just like I blessed David. Behold, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. So the Bible consistently praises the kingship of David. Romans 1st chapter, verse 3. Concerning God's son Jesus, who was born of a descendant of David according to the flesh. You go to Hebrews, the 11th chapter, where you get into the hall of fame of faith. David's name is listed in there, but not Solomon's. He's not in there. You go further on to the book of Revelations, the 22nd chapter, verse 16. Jesus speaking, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am the root and offspring of David, the bright and morning star. And I'm just saying from beginning to end, David's kingship is exalted. It's extolled. It's lifted up. His flag is being raised, but not so with Solomon. And you might ask, well, why is that? Because David had a lot of problems in his kingship. And I get that. The difference between David and Solomon was found in their difference in their relationship to God. From beginning to end, David was a God person, but he did mess up. I get that. And you get that. But early on, when he was Jesse's son, and he was just an obscure son at that, and Samuel had to go and find him, but he was the one that was anointed of God. He was the one that took on the giant Goliath. From early on to the very end right here, he's loved the Lord thy God. And he had a heart after God. And yes, he messed up. I get that. He messed up. But from beginning to end, he said, the secret to greatness is you descend and let God ascend and put him on the throne. And he repented of his sin, and he had consequences for his sin. And the consequences was a kingdom that it wasn't all that it was should have been. But he at least loved the Lord thy God from beginning to end. Not so with his son Solomon. I love the text about David in Psalms 84:10, where it says, for a day in thy courts is better than 1,000 outside. I would rather stand in the threshold of the house of God than dwell in the tents of the wicked. David said, let me get on the porch of God for one day. I'll be a lot happier there than a whole lifetime in the house of the wicked. Is that a hand of a question or comment? Worshiping works. Okay. There you go. It's God thing. So, but contrast David's mindset Godward to Solomon's, who had an unbelievable kingship. Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon said, chapter 1, verse 2, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. You get over to chapter 2, and he starts outlining the vanities of his life. He said, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was vanity. Anything that was pleasurable, he embraced. Verse 3, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine and how to take hold of it. So he didn't deprive himself of anything that he thought would be a benefit to his body. He said, I built houses for myself. Verse 4, I was very materialistic, and I built houses upon houses, multiple houses. Verse 7, I bought male and female slaves. He said, I prossessed and prospered with flocks and herds herds larger than all who preceded me. Verse 8, I collected for myself silver and gold and the pleasures of many concubines. And verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold any pleasure from myself. That's Solomon's testimony. Eat, drink, and be merry. Yeah, that was Solomon's testimony. And you see, contrast that with David's testimony. You read Solomon's testimony right here in chapter 23. He says, be a man under God. Give a right respect to God. What about Solomon's testimony at the end? 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4 through 8. It says, Solomon forsook God in the latter years, for it came about in the latter years that Solomon's wives turned his head away from God to seek other gods. That's how Solomon ended up. I don't know which one of the 700 wives or 300 concubines did it, but they turned his head. Do you think that would be a problem? Just maybe. And so you see the contrast between these two kings, what their mindset was Godward. It was radically different. Yes. Irony, though, he prayed for wisdom and got wisdom and still lived for self. That's the irony. He prayed for wisdom and got wisdom and still lived for himself. So David writes in verse 5, although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered and in all things secure. Those are great verses. Although my house is not so with... He knew that his household wasn't all it could have been and should have been. He knew that he had failed God on too many occasions. He knew that his kingship wasn't all that it could have been. Although my house is not so with God, it should have been better. It could have been better. Had it only prioritized some of the things early in life instead of later in life. It could have been better. And yet, he says, and yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. Oh, this is so beautiful. He says, for this is all my salvation and all my desire. He said, and yet I'm still saved. God has forgiven my house, forgiven me. I'm still going to heaven. It's not because of what I've done or what I haven't done. It's not because of my failures. I am in everlasting covenant relationship. It's not based on David's perfection as a ruler. It was based on God's gracious commitment in his everlasting covenant. This is good news for you and me. This is a text on eternal security. You know, by the way, if you haven't figured it out, I believe in the eternal security of the believer. I believe we didn't earn salvation. I believe we got salvation. And once saved, I don't think you can. If you didn't earn it, what makes you think you can lose it? I believe in once saved, always saved. Now, I understand there are some scriptures that are head-scratchers in that area, but I believe what Peter said, we have an inheritance, incorruptible, undefiled, and fadeth not away, secured in heaven. If it's secured in heaven, it's secure. Now, if I can lose it, well, what do I do to lose it? Now, you need to understand that's what David's saying here. It's not based on, yet my house isn't all it ought to be, yet God has secured me with an everlasting covenant. That's the goodness of God. I remember being a young Christian preacher. Jimmy Swaggart was incredibly popular on TV. Any of you remember Jimmy Swaggart? And I watched Jimmy Swaggart every single week. And I really like to watch Janet Paschal because she's so pretty. And so I'd watch Jimmy Swaggart. And he was a great preacher. I mean, I'd listen to him. He's an Assembly of God preacher. And he would romp and stomp, and he was good, and he would sweat. And, man, I really like that. I wanted to be like Jimmy Swaggart when I grew up. And I remember one day Jimmy Swaggart introduced the sermon, the most damnable doctrine in Christianity, the Baptist doctrine of eternal security. That's how he introduced it. It caught my ear because I believed in eternal security. And that's how he introduced it. The most damnable, there's a lot of doctrines out there, but the most damnable doctrine in Christianity, the doctrine of eternal security. And so he started romping and stomping and preaching. And back in those days, you can ask Maureen, I would argue with the TV evangelist. I would. He would preach, and I'd quote scriptures back to him. And Maureen said, they can't hear you. I said, but it makes me feel better. And the preachers would preach, and I was arguing with Jimmy Swaggart, and he didn't hear me. And he concluded that you can lose your salvation. And I'm just going, that's not true. And I don't know, 6 months after that, you remember Jimmy Swaggart fell in horrible sin. The strange flesh got a hold of him, and he went off the TV, and you couldn't see him on TV for another 6 months, and he fell from sin. And then all of a sudden it was announced Jimmy Swaggart is coming back to TV. He's going to have a first sermon coming back, and I didn't care where I was going to be. I was going to be there to hear that first sermon coming back because I really was curious as to what Jimmy Swaggart was going to say. Because if you can lose your salvation, what sin is it that you lose your salvation on? I would think that the messing around with another woman is pretty bad sin. I mean, I would think that one would be kind of like at the top of the list. And so if Jimmy Swaggart is true to his own doctrine, Jimmy Swaggart would come back and say, oh, God, I love you, and I want to be saved again. But that's not what he said. Jimmy Swaggart got back on the TV, and he said, Father, forgive me, for I have sinned. And I said, Jimmy, you're a Baptist. You just don't know it. Wait a second, Jimmy, you've committed an unbelievable sin. If you believed what you believed about the most damnable doctrine in eternity, you didn't need to say, Father, forgive me. You need to say, I'm lost again and need to be saved again. But that's not what he said. Note what David says. Yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. Although my house is not, I haven't lived a perfect life, and yes, I have sinned. Yet, he has made with me an everlasting covenant. This is good news for us, brothers and sisters. Will he not make it to increase? Who's going to bless? Do your works bless you, or is he the one that's going to bless? Yet, he will not make it, yet will he not make it increase? But the sons of rebellion, now these are the lost, but the sons of rebellion shall be as the thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and with the shaft of the spear. Man, that's straight out of Ephesians, put on the whole armor of God. And they shall be utterly burned with fire in their place. So David's saying, I have eternal security, the lost do not. For David, the entire theme, the whole theme of this book, this is a book, the Lord's in control, rest in him, give him his due, live his word, will, and way in your life, honor him, and live justly and righteously, and God will bless. Don't, and you won't be. You go to the book of Matthew, first chapter, first verse, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. What David is saying here is what the book of Proverbs says when it says, trust in the Lord with all thy heart and lean not into thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy path. So in closing, let me just spend a couple of minutes kind of dialoguing, making application for America and Americans. Where we are today. Do you believe that the vast majority of American leadership today love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, and all thy mind? No, it's not happening anymore. I've tried to document for your edification that not all of them, but a plurality of the founding fathers, it was a true statement. It was, but not so anymore. I couldn't help but notice yesterday, I'm on the mailing list of Liberty Institute, that's the civil rights group, I'm drawing a blank on his name. We support them. They defend Christians in courts and got their newsletter. And the whole documentation here is about the judges that have been nominated by Trump to take many of the courts and the grilling that they've been undergoing by the different senators. And I have all of the statements by the senators. And you just need to know what is taking place today in government is if you are a Christian and if you are running for office or getting ready to be a public service in office, you are being ridiculed and demonized and mocked and made fun of if you're a Christian. That's the norm today. And I have the documentation of it. What different senators said to different Christian representatives and all that was going on. And I have at least 10 and 15 of them here. You know, one after another after another. Some of it's just vile. Senator Dianne Feinstein specifically chastised then-nominee Amy Courtney Barrett, now a judge in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, regarding her faith, stating, "The dogma lives loudly within you, and that's a concern." The Christian dogma of you as a judge, it lives loudly. The force is strong in this one. She's a Christian and doesn't have a right to serve. And I've got quote after quote after quote of those Christians who are being mocked and demonized by other non-Christians in politics. And unfortunately, that's become the norm in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Have you heard anything nice said about Vice President Pence? I mean, because he's a Christian, he's an imbecile. And the list goes on and on and on and on. This is normative in our culture today. And I would want you to know it wasn't normative in the beginning. I have in front of me snippets of every single inaugural address up until recent times and what the president said about their faith and how important it was to guide them as they were presidents. It sounds just like David and his kingship. I'll just give you a couple of them. Starting with George Washington, "The propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the internal rules of order and right, which heaven itself has ordained." Second president, John Adams. This is the inauguration. This isn't the text of all they said. This is just the snippet from their inauguration. Second president, John Adams. "Veneration for the religion of a people who profess and call themselves Christians and a fixed resolution to consider a decent respect for Christianity among the best recommendations for public servants." The best public servants are Christian public servants. That's what he said in his inauguration. And now if you're a Christian in public service, you're demonized and mocked and ridiculed. But John Adams says it's the most important thing if you're going to be a public servant. Sixth president, John Quincy Adams, "Knowing that except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh in vain, with fervent supplications for his favor to his overruling providence, I commit with humble my fearless confidence, my own fate in the future destinies of the country. I'm going to live humbly before my God, who is my king." William Henry Harrison, ninth president, "I deem the present occasion sufficiently important and solemn to justify me in expressing to my fellow citizens a profound reverence for the Christian religion and a thorough conviction that sound morals, religious liberty, and a just sense of religious responsibility are essentially connected with all true and lasting happiness." Is that hard to understand? He said, it's real important that the Christian faith be part and parcel with who we are leading our country. 13th President Millard Fillmore, he said, "And I rely upon him who holds in his hands the destinies of nations to endow me with the requisite strength for the task and to avert from our country the evils apprehended in this day." And so the list just goes on and on. There's a couple of them here that are just unbelievably profound. Warren Harding, 29th president, "I must utter my belief in the divine inspiration of the founding fathers. Surely this must have been God's intent in making of this new World Republic. America is ready to encourage that brotherhood of mankind, which must be God's highest conception of human relationship. I implore the favor and guidance of God in this heaven. I have taken the solemn oath of office on that passage of Holy Writ wherein it is asked, 'What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God?'" And the 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, "America seeks no earthly empires built on blood and force. The legions which she sends forth are armed not with the sword, but with the cross. The higher state to which she seeks the allegiance of all mankind is not human, but divine origin. She cherishes no purpose to save the merit, but save the merit of Almighty God." We do what we do not to conquer other people. We're not barbarians to subjugate and to conquer. We do what we do for the welfare of mankind. To the glory of God, we do what we do under the banner of the cross. That was future, past presidents, but present tense leaders take just the opposite at every opportunity. They subjugate, they denigrate, they ridicule Christians. That's where we are today. And so you wonder why we're in such a mess today? What did David say? David said, do justly and be a person under God and be blessed. But all too often today, the people that lead are like Adam and Eve. Let's eat the fruit and then we shall be like Most High God. We don't want to be subjected to, we want to be. And so that's what you have in this day. Who would have ever thought that in the land of the free and in the home of the brave, socialism would be honestly contemplated? Lenin said, go read any history book, Lenin said, the goal of socialism is communism. That's the goal of socialism. Now, you understand when you talk about a democracy and a republic, God's involved there. When you talk about communism, God is not involved. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, having spent 17 years in a gulag in prison when he got out, finally wrote his memoirs and his books. And what did he say about the Soviet Union? He won the Nobel Prize. He said, man has forgotten God, and that's why all this has happened. To sum up all of the testimony of the communism, which is the byproduct of socialism, to sum it all up, we tried to get rid of God, and it didn't work. And that's why all this has happened. Patrick Henry said, it is when people forget God that tyrants forge their chains. I would suggest to you that our chains are being forged. President Eisenhower said, it is necessary that we earnestly seek out and uproot any traces of communists at any place wherever it affects our national life. You understand that both sides had spies, and spies were captured by both sides. And you understand that we captured captured Soviet spies, and they captured American spies. And we really did get the game plan of Soviet Union as to how to subjugate America. We got their game plan. It came out in the book, Naked Communist, and so they weren't coy about it. They knew they couldn't subjugate us like Muggeridge said, as a barbarian coming over the gate. They had to do it within, and Muggeridge was right, but he wasn't the first to say it. Understand that Representative Albert Herlong Jr. of Florida entered into the congressional record on January 10th, 1963, what the Soviet communist game plan was to subjugate America. He gave it, and I'm going to give it to you. He said, here's what the Soviets said they're going to do in order to make America a less powerful country. Number one, eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression in the schools on the ground that it violates the principle of separation of church and state. Number two, eliminate laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech. Number three, use technical decisions of the courts to weaken basic American institutions by claiming that their activities violate civil rights, like the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. Number four, discredit American culture. Discredit the family as an institution. Encourage promiscuity and divorce. Number five, present homosexuality, degeneracy, and promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Number six, emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents. Infiltrate churches and replace revealed theology with social religion. Number seven, discredit the Bible and emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need a religious crutch. Number eight, discredit the Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step with modern needs, a hindrance to cooperation between nations on a worldwide basis. Number nine, discredit the founding fathers. Present them as selfish aristocrats who have no concern for the common man. Number 10, control the schools. Use them as a transmission belt for socialism. That could never happen, could it? Number 11, soften the curriculum. Get control of the teachers' associations. Number 12, infiltrate the press. Control book review assignments, editorial writing, policy-making decisions. Control key positions in radio, television, and motion pictures. That could never happen, could it? And number whatever, 13, belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history. Folk, that's not Chuck preaching. That's entered into congressional record in 1963. How much of it had come to pass? All of it. It's gotten too late. We are in the midst, whether you realize it or not, we are in the midst of a cultural, spiritual, civil war. We cannot just focus on family anymore. If we want to save the soul of our nation, we are in the midst of a cultural, civil war. The forces of evil are out to destroy our country. If my people who are called by my name would humble themselves and pray, it's about God's church and God's people being God's church and God's people. So here we are. Most of you are like me. You're not in the beginnings of life. You're not even in the twilight. You're not in the middle of life. You're beyond the middle bar. You're in the third or fourth quarter. How are you going to finish? Are you going to finish well? Don't you want to finish well? Be a man under God. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. May we think through David's admonition for us today. We love justice. We love righteousness. In order to do it rightly, we got to be people who live in fear, awe of God. You are our God. We are your subject. We've been placed here with gifts and skills to be part of the body of Christ. May we not shirk those responsibilities. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Brother Chuck loves you, brothers and sisters. Brother Stewart will be back next week. God bless you. Go to the garage sale, all right?